All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome, or good morning, depending on where you're tuning in from. Good morning, good afternoon. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Session 1. My name is Sarah Levy, and I am your moderator today from Washington, D.C. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online resources, technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Let's cover some of our housekeeping rules for today before we proceed any further. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not available to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. Use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems at any time. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of the modules today. For those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, those will be available upon completion of the feedback form at the end of the training. Once you complete the form and check the box to certify that you participated, the certificate will be provided to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating in today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active ITRC member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warrant the material nor endorse the specific products. All right, so on this slide, now you can see on the screen, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers for today. All of them served as members of the VI mitigation team and volunteered to support the training offered today. So on slide number 5, which you see now on the screen, I am going to pass this off to Kelly Johnson, a VI specialist from the North Carolina Brownfields Program at the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality in Raleigh, North Carolina. Kelly is going to orient us all for the training today. So welcome, Kelly.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Let's see. Let's make sure I've got control here. Welcome everybody to the training today. We've got a couple of good topics here for session one. Today we're going to talk about the conceptual site models for VI mitigation, the public outreach during VI mitigation, rapid response of ventilation, the outreach materials that were prepared for that, and the remediation and institutional controls as vapor intrusion mitigation outreach materials. There we go. What you should learn today, we're going to talk about a quick background of the vapor intrusion mitigation training team. We'll go through a quick overview of the available documentation. I'll talk to you about how to access these mitigation strategies. And the previous slide, actually, we talked about what's going to be discussed today, and CSM will be the next one coming up. It's important here to note what is not covered in this mitigation training. Emergency response actions, you need to immediately contact first responders in the events of reports of strong petroleum odors or evidence of combustible, explosive, or oxygen deficient conditions inside the building. One other thing that we do not cover here, there's some bleed over between the two, but we do not cover methane mitigation or hazardous substances that have that high explosive potential. And again, while there's also some bleed over between VI mitigation for contaminants like this and radon, we are not covering radon. There's no real spot to put this because it's a very short part in the documents that we prepared for this team. But there's an emerging technologies outreach materials section. Currently, there's just one of them in there. The idea here is to capture technologies and strategies that are not exclusively mitigation or remediation, and to really act as a placeholder for emerging technologies in the future. And right now, we just have the aerobic vapor mitigation barriers, which create that aerobic bio barrier for petroleum vapors below a structure. If you've made your way over here to ITRC, and especially for VI, it's real important to become familiar with these documents here. There's the 2007 VI Pathway of Practical Guideline. A lot of states base some of their initial stuff on that. There's a lot of good information in there. And on the right there is the 2014 Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Document. And don't let the name fool you there, especially in the appendices of that is actually an amazing amount of information from sampling and mitigation and things like that. And so I highly encourage you to go and poke through those. It's also important to note here that there's a new vapor intrusion team that ITRC has started up. I think we've got about 200 members so far, and the idea there is to combine these three documents, the 2007, 2014, and this mitigation one into one document. And for this particular team, the mitigation training team, there were multiple requests for additional details and training on the mitigation components. We're kind of assuming if you're talking about mitigation that you're already somewhat aware of vapor intrusion. But it's important here that at least we make sure everybody's on the same page. So what is vapor intrusion? Contaminants that are released into the soil and groundwater that can volatilize into soil gas. And vapor intrusion occurs when these vapors migrate upward into the overlying buildings and contaminate indoor air. And if they're present at sufficiently high concentrations, these vapors may pose a threat to the health and safety of the building occupants. That's important here to note as well, preferential pathways. You can see there if soil gases are up. If vapors are diffusing through the soil gas, making their way up, you know, it takes time and you have to go through certain things. But if you've got a preferential pathway, a direct route, a compromised utility or something like that, you can imagine that the vapors would come straight into the structure. There's two different types of vapor intrusion, chlorinated vapor intrusion, which addresses chlorinated compounds, and then petroleum vapor intrusion, which is a subset that deals exclusively with the petroleum hydrocarbon contaminants. It's important to know what you're dealing with at a site, and many sites might have combined chlorinated and petroleum as well, but you might have a different mitigation approach depending on what your contaminant or site concerns are. So vapor mitigation, you implement it to reduce the indoor air contaminants due to vapor intrusion below applicable action or screening levels and to protect the building occupants. This can be accomplished by modifying the vapor intrusion pathway to reduce the max flux of contaminants entering the building. See here. And oops, sorry. And reducing the indoor air contaminant, and you reduce the indoor air contaminant concentrations by removal. So you could reroute the vapors around the structure, dilution, you could add makeup air. And there's also diffusion. You can address the diffusion as well, which is adding like a vapor barrier to the structure. So VI mitigation or vapor control. So VOC is volatile organic compounds, but VOC vapor control can include source remediation, which is where you're targeting the source release there for the volatiles. The volatiles. Active or passive mitigation, which addresses the building envelope right at the interface between the subsurface and the building. Rapid response, which is typically implemented to address indoor air. In a quick manner and is typically used to buy you time to start figuring out what you're going to do for active or passive mitigation approaches. And then there's institutional controls, which place legal or regulatory requirements on the property in order to protect public health. This is kind of an important part here, and it's about the steps in the vapor intrusion mitigation process. And it's important to keep these in mind as you go through this session today and then session two in 2 weeks. There's the pre-system installation components, which is where you do an assessment of the site conditions. work on your CSM. Two is about your technology selection, is how you're going to tackle and protect the building occupants. And three is to develop and document your system design. And that may include submitting to a regulatory authority for approval or oversight. For the system installation part, you've got the pre-construction meeting, which is extremely important. It really is to have everyone on site, from the low-level plumbers and electricians all the way up to the site owners. You need to make sure that everybody has buy-in for what you're trying to do, and that anybody could honestly compromise it. And continuously too throughout the entire process, especially for new construction, they'll replace crews over time. So you'll also have the installation, and the installation oversight is also another incredibly important part to make sure that you oversee every part that goes in with verification and logging to make sure that it's exactly what was designed. And there's post-system installation items. There's system verification, which is additional inspections, verification sampling, which may include subslab or indoor air sampling, and confirming the performance QA/QC, which can be things like a pilot test, or pressure field extension and things like that to make sure that you've influenced the entire slab if you took a active or passive mitigation approach. There's the documentation, which could include submitting to your regulatory authorities for approval and things like that, and the long-term stewardship of the mitigation system, the operation, maintenance, and monitoring. On the bottom right here is a website for the ITRC, the vapor intrusion mitigation documents. And there's this thing called an interactive directory on there, and you'll see that on the right side of the screen. And I highly encourage you to have that up as you go through session one today and for session two in 2 weeks. Each one of those little boxes there is actually a clickable link, and it'll take you to that fact sheet or checklist and things like that. It's incredibly useful. It's designed to kind of get you to the topic fast. And there's a button at the top of each of those pages to go back here to the interactive directory. And so on here, we've got the interactive directory. We've got fact sheets, technology information sheets, which dive in. And of course, these modules coming up in session one or two are going to go into details on these. There's the flow chart for VICSM development, and that is it's got a lot of info on it, but it's really good. And we'll cover that just right after I'm done here. There's considerations and impacts of the various vapor intrusion mitigation approaches. There's checklists and, of course, additional information. And again, I highly encourage you to have that kind of pulled up as you go through these two sessions. And to target in on the supporting information boxes there with the design consideration, post-installation, and OM&M fact sheets, we use the Harvey Ball system, kind of like a consumer reports here, to go through each of these considerations. So you've got the categories, the principal consideration, and the subject matter, and we talk about if it's a high impact, medium, or low impact. There's a lot of information on these, and I think just to target one of them with the system there, the Harvey Ball system, if you go into the subgrade soil type and focus on that, we actually go into details as to why an active mitigation approach is considered high impact, and there's links there to go to the technology information sheets and things like that. And we also talk about the low impact. So each one of these has additional details in it, kind of idea. VI is not simple, especially if you're here, you've probably figured that out. And the idea is to try to get all this together in one spot. And then you can also target yourself and go to the technology information sheets and fact sheets for more information. There's checklists for system design and post installation and the OM&M. You can take these for your state agency or your private firm and modify them as you need. They've got clickable checkboxes, editable fields. We talk about the specific categories, a primary prompt to target you underneath that, and there's additional prompts to record supporting information. These are very useful, and these will be covered as well in later modules. And so with that, it's my honor here to hand this over to Lila and Laurent for the CSM items. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. Yeah, this is Lila Beckley with GSI Environmental, and I'm pleased to kick off the CSM for Vapor Intrusion Mitigation module. There we go. So in this module, we'll talk about how the conceptual site model evolves through the life cycle of a project, how it can be used to guide the selection and design of different mitigation approaches, and then how it can help evaluate system effectiveness. This module's got three main objectives. First, we'll explain what a mitigation CSM is and why it's important. We'll also identify different types of data needed to enhance the conceptual site model for vapor intrusion mitigation and introduce you to some tools you can use for that purpose that are provided in the ITRC documents. And then finally, we'll show you how the mitigation CSM fits into the mitigation evaluation and design process. So I keep using this phrase, mitigation CSM. What is this thing anyway? Why is it important? So, stepping back, a conceptual site model in general is a way to visualize site conditions. For vapor intrusion, it describes the vapor intrusion pathway from your subsurface source, be it a petroleum source or chlorinated solvent source. It describes transport processes, such as diffusion and advection, and then it describes the potential receptors that you may have. So this conceptual site model is initially developed during the investigation phase of a project, and it helps us understand if the vapor intrusion pathway is complete and whether mitigation is required in the first place. So unfortunately, while the conceptual site model developed during site investigation is enough to help you understand that some follow-up action, such as mitigation, is needed, it may not be actually detailed enough to help you design and implement a mitigation approach. So as Kelly mentioned, this purpose of mitigation is to reduce the concentrations or the potential for exposure. And further on in the training, we'll be talking about a variety of different approaches, a lot of different choices that are available for that. And it can be hard to choose between all the different mitigation alternatives. But if you think about mitigation as modifying specific parts of the vapor intrusion pathway from the source all the way to the receptor, you're more likely to select an approach that will work for your site and then understand how and why it works. So these are the details that are captured in the mitigation CSM. It's important also to recognize that additional information may be needed to enhance your basic conceptual site model to make it mitigation grade or mitigation ready so that you can appropriately evaluate and choose these different mitigation alternatives. So Kelly touched on this a moment ago, and I will go into a little bit more detail about different ways to modify or control the vapor intrusion pathway. So as Kelly mentioned, these strategies can include controlling the VOC source, basically conducting remedy to reduce the VOC concentrations directly at the subsurface source. So these strategies that may include source removal or treatment, they're usually longer-term components of the overall mitigation strategy. You can also control the rate at which vapors can enter the building by installing systems that affect the conditions at or near the base of the building. This is usually done with either active systems, such as sub-slab depressurization systems, or passive systems, such as use of barriers alone. We can also reduce concentrations inside the building itself through ventilation or indoor air treatment. These are often considered rapid response actions, as we'll be discussed later on in this session. And then finally, we can use institutional controls as a component of the mitigation approach. For example, institutional controls can be used to require operation of the mitigation systems into the future or restrict certain uses, say to non-residential, as a way to control exposure. So the key point here is that all these different approaches reduce the potential for exposure due to vapor intrusion by controlling different physical portions or elements of the vapor intrusion pathway. Okay, so let's go through an example. This is a fairly simple, small building. In this scenario, say we've done a vapor intrusion investigation and we've determined that indoor air concentrations exceed action levels, although the concentrations are below the rapid response criteria. To address potential exposure to VOCs in indoor air, we might consider controlling the rate vapors enter the building. So we'll be thinking about controlling vapor flux by doing something near the slab or the foundation of the building. So just knowing that vapor intrusion is occurring and vapors are entering the building isn't enough. More information will likely be needed on that bottom portion of the building, basically the slab or sub-slab conditions, to evaluate whether an active or a passive mitigation approach would be appropriate. Different types of information could include the sub-slab chemical concentrations. This can affect the degree of the control required of your mitigation system. Could also affect the potential for diffusion of VOCs through the slab or vapor flux through cracks in the slab. So, sub-slab soil and vapor moisture conditions are also important to understand because these can affect the extent to which airflow and negative pressures can be induced below the slab if you're thinking about an active sub-slab depressurization system. Similarly, slab integrity is important. That's another factor that can affect the ability to extend negative pressures below the slab. And we'll go into a lot more detail about this particular topic in the second training module. But finally, building features that block or short circuit sub-slab airflow, that's another example of something that's important to know for your mitigation CSM, because if you have foundation or block walls, that will also limit the effectiveness of your sub-slab depressurization system potentially, because it would limit the ability to extend a ne negative pressure field below the slab. So a key point here is that these details might not have been part of the original vapor intrusion conceptual site model used to determine that the pathway was a concern. You will, however, need to this information to basically flesh out your CSM, make it mitigation grade, so to speak, to help you choose and design your mitigation approach. Here's another example of things to think about when you're thinking about mitigation. This is a pretty important topic that has come up a lot in the last few years, especially in the research world, and we're seeing it more and more in regulatory guidance, and that is the so-called preferential pathways. These can play an important role in both the potential for vapor intrusion and then the resulting mitigation requirements. So they really need to be considered in your conceptual site model. These preferential pathways can be thought of as high permeability conduits that can serve as a high capacity transport pathway connecting your subsurface VOC source into your building. So these can be things like sewer pipes, open pipes, basically that directly connect the building foundations or the interior with the source of vapor. If this particular pathway is a concern, it really does change your mitigation strategy because your potential actions might include adding check valves to sewer laterals to keep the vapors from entering the building, or lining the sanitary sewer, for instance, to prevent contamination from entering the sewer mains and then going into the building. So you have to think about mitigation in a different way if this is a factor. Later on in this session, we'll talk a little bit more about specific things that can be done to help address preferential pathways and vapor entry points. So something else to consider in the context of these preferential pathways is that these pathways can dominate vapor intrusion in some cases. And so common mitigation approaches such as sub-slab depressurization might not be enough or may not be the right approach at all if the VOCs are entering the building via these types of features. So very important considerations. Okay, so I've discussed two relatively simple scenarios up to this point, but what about large, more complicated buildings? You can guess the answer. You're going to have large, more complicated problems. But the need to understand the mitigation CSM becomes even more important in these scenarios because you've got the potential for multiple sources and variable conditions throughout your building. So the figure on this slide is a cross-section through part of a large building. In this example, on the left side, we've got a dissolved phase groundwater plume that intersects a sanitary sewer. And then on the right side, we've got a solvent release that's immediately below the slab. Because of the configuration and where the contaminants are located, this sets up a potential preferential pathway from the sewer, and then you may have advecate flow through the floor drains as well. You also could have the potential for diffusion, the more conventional type of vapor intrusion. This building also has two different additions. So there's a new addition with a tighter shell on the left side of the building, tighter shell, more uniform foundation with an intact concrete over permeable gravel, which is very different to the left or the right side of the building, where in the original structure you now have degraded concrete and leaky shell, and then variability in the permeability of the backfill underneath the building. So these are all quite different conditions that you'll have to think about differently as you think about mitigation. So because of the variety of variables in this building, you'll end up developing multiple mitigation CSMs that may ultimately require multiple vapor control strategies. And the details of the building really do have a big effect on the overall mitigation approach or approaches that you choose. So in a short-term, potentially rapid response perspective, you might seal the preferential pathways, seal up sewers, floor drains, things like that. If the building's heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system is appropriate, you might positively pressurize the new addition where it's tighter, where you have more control of the pressure. On the other hand, ventilation might work better on the original side of the building, where the building itself just tends to be more leaky. So your mitigation may basically enhance the characteristics that the building already has. Where and how you'd apply a sub-slab depressurization or sub-slab venting system would also be affected by the different sub-slab materials. So you could take advantage of the gravel layer in the new addition on the left side of the image. You could take advantage of that by applying an active or a passive venting system, whereas the lack of gravel throughout the subfloor on the right side would really limit your capability to do that. On the old section of the building, you may only be able to do active venting in focused areas. And then thinking long term, you might treat the dissolved phase groundwater plume or apply SVE on the shallower solvent release. And then depending on the time frame for mitigation, you may apply institutional control over the whole structure as another way to control exposure. So lots of different things going on in the building that leads to lots of different potential ways to apply different remediation technologies. Okay, so that's going to lead us to our first knowledge check. Sarah is going to kick off a poll here. And so the question to the audience is, what is a component of the mitigation CSM? Contaminant type, distance between the VOC source and the building, location and depth of sanitary sewers, condition of the slab, all of the above, or none of the above? So we give you a few moments to answer. And then Sarah, when you're ready, can switch to the showing the answers.
All right, we're just going to give it maybe 10 more seconds. We still got some answers coming in.
Okay, great. We need hold music.
All right, we are going to wrap up the poll now. And you should be able to see those results on your screen.
Great. So the vast majority of folks chose all of the above, which is the correct answer. So in a general situation, you want to think about all these different pieces because they will have some effect on your mitigation strategy. Some factors may be more important than others for a particular building, but in general, you want to look at sort of the full spectrum of building conditions. Okay, and with that, I'm going to pass it to Laurent to talk more about the tools to use to help figure out the CSM.
Hi, thank you, Layla. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Perfect. So good afternoon, good morning. I'm Laurent Levy with Jacobs, and I will continue on with the CSM module. As Layla alluded to, the mitigation CSM can have a lot of detail and one tool to help organize that information and select possible mitigation approaches is the flow chart that's shown right on your screen. And you can find this flow chart in the CSM fact sheet on the ITRC VI website. So don't try to read it yet. We'll walk you through an example. The flow chart captures three key elements of the CSM in one diagram, the source that you're seeing right here. The transport, let me see if I can advance this, the transport right here, and the receptor. And as you can see, the source part of that diagram is at the top, is at the bottom, and the receptor part is at the top to mirror vapor intrusion that's occurring from the subsurface into the building indoor air and the occupant. And to see how this flow chart works, let's focus on a portion of the diagram. So let me click here. As you can see, there are a set of boxes which represent different components of the CSM, and they're linked together with a set of arrows and valves. So let's do an example. So let's assume that our CSM indicates that VI is occurring from groundwater. So the VOCs dissolved in groundwater volatilize, they migrate upward by diffusion, the installed gas within the vital zone. And then the VOCs are entering the building via either concrete diffusion or advection through cracks, or a combination of both diffusion and advection. And so we, on that chart, we checked all the corresponding boxes and we highlighted the arrows corresponding to this particular migration pathway. And as you can see on the diagram here, there are also valves, and each of these valves represent a mean of cutting off the VI pathway. So for instance, consider P. Let me get my little pen here. The laser pointer. So consider P that's shown right here. We could close these valves and stop the vapor entry into the building by implementing one of the subslab vapor controls that's shown right here to the right of P. As you can see, this include the vapor barriers, subslab depressurization, or subslab ventilation, and you'll hear more of these in the active and passive mitigation modules. Can do another example. Let's take a look. Instead of valve P, let's take a look at valve M right here. And if you were to shut off that valve, you'd be cutting off the sole gas upward migration. And this could be achieved by vapor extraction or removal right here. We have an example here, like sole vapor extraction, biodegradation, bioventing. So all of these would be a way of cutting off the valve M, and these will be discussed in the remediation module of this program. So this flow chart, in other words, can help you determine on the basis of the CSM for a particular building what remediation or mitigation options are available in your toolbox to address vapor intrusion. And again, you can find this flow chart in the CSM fact sheet. Right, let's move to the next slide. Another tool to help develop the mitigation CSM is the checklist that I believe Kelly talked about a little earlier in this program. And this document is also available on the TRCVI mitigation website. The purpose of this checklist is to help guide mitigation planning. It highlights important factors that should be considered for different elements of the VI pathway. So the checklist assumes that VI characterization has been completed and that it's been determined that mitigation is necessary at a building. The checklist can help further identify consideration of the CSM relating to VI mitigation, and it can also help support evaluation of mitigation alternatives. So in this checklist, you'll find the mitigation goals at the beginning, and this helps the user focus on site features that are relevant to development of a mitigation plan to meet those goals. The next sections of the checklist follow the same organization as the flowchart, so on the previous slide, source, transport, receptor, and the users can fill in the sections that are appropriate to their situation. So for instance, we talked about source remediation earlier. If it's the goal, then the building details may not be very important. You don't really need to know everything about the building to do bioremediation, for example. But by contrast, if building mitigation is the goal, you may want to fill out section 5 that you're seeing on your screen. Building section of the checklist should be completed to help verify that key information has been collected. So, all right, let's go to the next slide. Can you open the poll, Sarah? Oops, I need to go there. Somehow it won't go to the next slide. There we go. All right, so the question is, when is it important to verify and update the mitigation CSM? Is it during mitigation design and planning? Is it at the time of mitigation implementation? Is it during long-term management? Or is it all of the above? Or never? So take a few seconds to answer the poll. And then in 3 seconds there, we'll close it. We can look at the results. 3, 2, 1. All right, let's check. Looks like 88% of the people got it right. So a small group of this program selected during mitigation design and planning. And really the answer is all of the above. And this is perhaps one of the most important lessons of this module. The CSM is not something that's simply developed at the time of mitigation design and then forgotten about. Obviously, you want to develop it early on, but it's also something that should be reevaluated throughout the life cycle of the project. Once your mitigation is operating, you may want to reassess your CSM, see if there are improvements, see if it's still needed, see if it needs to be expanded, and so forth. All right, next slide. Here are a few additional resources for your consideration. These will explore the VICSM, and I think Kelly mentioned a couple of them. First, to your left, the ITRCVI guidance from 2007, probably to be updated soon. Second, in the middle, the ITRC Petroleum VI guidance from 2014, the so-called PVI guidance, which includes Petroleum VI CSM checklist at Appendix D, but it's relevant for not just Petroleum VI, but all of VI. It's a good resource. And finally, to your right, the CSM for VI mitigation fact sheet on the ITRC website. Struggling with advancing those slides. All right, there you go. So, in summary, there are three things to remember from the CSM module. First, the VI CSM that you developed during that characterization should continue to evolve as your plans for mitigation are developed and you move mitigation towards long-term operations. Second, considering using the flowchart and the checklist in support of your CSM. These are tools that can help you determine the specific value pathways relevant to the building to mitigate, and they can also help identify options for successful vapor control strategies. One note, these tools address relatively common VI scenario. They do not include every possibility, but they can help you think through VI mitigation in a more systematic way. And finally, the VI mitigation CSM can also support public outreach. So if it can help you explain the mitigation approach, frame some key aspects and describe how and why mitigation will work. So that's a good tool for public communication. So this concludes the CSM module. I'm now turning over to Jennifer Borski at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Jennifer's going to tell us more about public outreach during VI mitigation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Okay. Just going to make sure that I have the ability to advance. It looks like I do. Wonderful. So, hello, everyone. This is Jennifer Borski with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Thank you, Laurent. We're going to talk to you about public outreach during the vapor intrusion mitigation module, and we'll be going over all of these flower petals during my part of the presentation. So, after completing this module, we hope that you will understand that vapor mitigation public outreach can be different from other types of environmental outreach. There are a number of great risk and public outreach documents available for your use that will go over that. But for our document, the public outreach document, we tried to focus on how public outreach might be different for vapor intrusion and vapor mitigation projects in general. Outreach is necessary before mitigation, continues throughout the project into the long-term management and through the exit strategy. We have our own fact sheet for public outreach, but also included a small section in each one of the vapor mitigation fact sheets to emphasize the importance of this. And we also hope that you understand public outreach requires diverse approaches, must be repeated in a variety of ways, and is really everyone's job. So let's talk about some of the ways that vapor intrusion outreach could be different. One of the first big differences is that the bulk of the investigation takes place inside. So as opposed to other environmental investigations, we're not drilling a hole out in the yard. We're drilling a hole in a place where people work and where they live. So this is really intrusive, and this needs to be discussed in conversations with the affected individuals. Completing mitigation and the long-term stewardship that goes along with it depends on continued access to the inside of people's homes and their workplaces. So we need to recognize that what we're asking is routine for us, but it's a big deal for owners and occupants, and it's important to first build a relationship. Vapor intrusion is also generally more unfamiliar to most people than other environmental issues. So VI is still relatively new, hasn't gotten the press a lot that many other environmental issues have, although it is getting in the newspaper more and more. But you're likely going to have more things to explain to help people understand what is happening. And most importantly, it's about the air that we breathe. So this can cause a lot of added anxiety. For example, we do have a choice about whether or not to turn on the tap. We can have a replacement bottled water supply, etc. But we don't have the option about whether or not to breathe. So this additional loss of control can create a lot of added anxiety. And while we can't tell people how they need to feel, we do need to understand that this added anxiety is having an impact on the way that they process and ask questions. So throughout these conversations, we just need to have an awareness that there's this anxiety. So we need to be proactive in our communications and help people feel as comfortable as they can as we move through this process. And then another thing to think about is that vapor mitigation involves permanent building modifications. So we're talking about putting holes in the floor, running pipes up along the structure, installing a fan that's going to be running continuously, maybe in perpetuity. So we've included in our fact sheet a matrix of concerns that you are likely to encounter. And we listed these and other topics to serve as a resource for you. To the next slide there. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the comprehensive nature of vapor mitigation outreach and some of the key components. As with all projects, outreach needs to be considered early and often. It just does. That's something we should all be aware of. Public outreach is often an afterthought, unfortunately, but that's really not the best strategy. So transparency is important. Since it's so unfamiliar to most people, occupants and owners are going to need a larger amount of time and a larger amount of information for vapor intrusion work than they would for other environmental work. And that transparency really serves to build trust. So when they come up with questions later, they feel comfortable coming and asking those questions, and then answers can be given from a reputable source that has an established relationship. And those relationships need to be maintained to ensure continued access and cooperation. So routine communications in informal settings, like kitchen table conversations, might be needed to maintain those relationships and also ensure continued access. And depending on the community, partners or intermediaries may be needed to assist with translating, gaining trust and access. And it may be especially important in environmental justice communities where the owners and or the occupants may not have had the time or the resources to get educated on environmental issues or may not feel empowered to even ask questions. So it's important to make sure that these affected individuals understand what's happening and that mitigation projects address their needs. But above all, we need to listen. Listening to the concerns of the building owners and occupants is really a key part of communication. While our public outreach document attempts to help you prepare for what those concerns might be, it is not a substitute for determining what people at a particular site will care about. So communicating about vapor intrusion can be complicated. We're talking about unfamiliar words, intrusion, mitigation, we talk about pressure field extension, micrograms per cubic meter. These are all words and terms that people are not familiar with, and it's going to take them a longer time to process. So you need to spend more time communicating with owners and occupants, and you're definitely going to want to leave something with them so that they know how to ask questions that they think of later. And it's not just the words that are unfamiliar. Vapor work has a lot of things to measure and compare. And many of the things that we measure won't specifically cause a human health issue, but they're triggers to help us know when to look for indoor air. So for example, if we collect subslab samples or soil gas data, maybe a state relies on groundwater screening levels to trigger investigations. Affected parties can look at publicly available screening tables and see that the data is above that, like for example, subslab, but they don't fully understand that that's not actually the air that they're breathing. So it's really key to incorporate explanations of the different samples that are being collected right from the beginning, help them understand the difference of what's being measured and how it affects them. The variability, that can be by orders of magnitude. The data is really variable, both spatially and temporally. So interpreting it, that's challenging even for environmental professionals. So it's important to communicate to owners and operators that we expect that variability and how we plan to address that. And then the background contributions from common consumer products can really muddy the water. It's complicated to explain an elevated concentration related to a background source. It just is. It's important to clarify for people that that is not necessarily regulated. And these sources, if they're indoor air sources, and really defer them to some local health departments or others that can help them understand if they're concerned about those results. So while we're at the mitigation stage, we're generally past this part of complication, but it is important to emphasize that potential confusion and frustration that can carry forward into the mitigation phase if we're not adequately addressing it during the investigation. Okay. That is not advancing for me. Sarah, are you able to? I'm not sure why. I don't know if I've got a delay here, but are you able to advance the slide for me?
Just give me one moment.
Thank you. And then why don't you try to give me control back and I'll try to take it from here. Thank you. So communicating about vapor intrusion mitigation is just as complicated as trying to communicate about vapor intrusion in the first place. So it's best if we can use some analogies. We can try telling people that we're going to install a fan, forms an invisible pressure barrier beneath their building to protect them, but you know that might not hit home. So most people are familiar, they've heard before about radon mitigation, but they've at least heard of it. Maybe some of them have some experience with it. So we've listed some states' guidance in our public outreach document as a resource for you, and many of them are aimed at the public and explain systems in a way that is helpful. So we want to continue to address these questions as they arise, and whenever possible, partner up. It's really important to rely on specialized Department of Health staff, sometimes even doctors, for health communication. And as our public outreach document points out, it's important to include people like local health officials and others in our outreach plan so that they're available if questions arise. So next slide. All right. And questions from the public. So as we move through the mitigation, the investigation into the mitigation, the questions become less about the mechanics of vapor intrusion and understanding that whole pathway and more about the logistics and property values. So they might start to worry that their schedule or their time is going to be disrupted. What's their electric bill going to be? How loud is this going to be? Who's paying for this? All those kinds of questions. The document for public outreach incorporates possible concerns into a matrix. And a simple fact sheet might be able to help address many of these questions. Others can be addressed by simply being responsive. So for example, maybe it can be worked out to hide that ugly pipe with like a false chimney that matches their facade. But regardless of whatever the concerns are, the point is they're important. They're important to the building owner, they're important to the occupants, and they need to be addressed. So this maintains that trust and cooperation that's already been established. Okay, great. That's back to working for me. So we might need to consider multiple communication tools. Actually, just plan on it. As your project progresses, you're probably going to have repeated conversations with the same party as the nature of the questions are going to change. And remember to emphasize that the reason for the mitigation is to protect their health. We want to use multiple methods of communication. So group settings and one-on-one discussions, both have a place. Remember, mitigation specific questions will come up that people might have had the wherewithal to think of during our initial outreach and conversations when concerns about health were high and everything was just really unfamiliar. So leaving a fact sheet with some contact information is a great idea. Social media, dedicated internet sites are also a great resource to reach people, especially if it's for a larger neighborhood area. All right, and communication is everyone's job. So we need to realize that a communication is really a component of the entire project. Vapor mitigation projects, they have a lot of moving parts. A lot of coordination goes into it, and a lot of people involved. Every single one of those interactions with the owners and the occupants matters. And perception matters. So you might be saying all the right things, but if their perception is that they're not being heard or they're not being able to fully understand, we have to try harder. So consider that mitigation field personnel and designers are going to be most likely interacting with the people that are in their houses or in their businesses. And they're not necessarily trained communicators, and they don't necessarily have the full picture of the project or what's going on or the liability associated with it, et cetera. So every stakeholder does play a role in the communication. And it's especially important to be mindful of situations where the occupant is not the owner. The resident might not have had all of the information that was provided to the owner, or vice versa. So it's really falls to the consultant's responsibility to inform the mitigator and the field personnel and any subcontractors what can be shared while they're at their property. And probably more importantly, who to direct them to get some additional information. And this coordination actually has to take place and happen before mobilizing to the property so that everybody is certain about what's okay to say and what needs to be referred to later. All right, so moving into long-term management, it's really a key part of the success. We want to make sure that all the hard work that's gone into identifying and installing a system continues to work. So we can't simply then, after all of this work, hand over a manual to the owner or occupant and just hope for the best. Different states are going to have different methods of addressing long-term management, and it may not always be with the responsible party. So we'll need to have a plan to communicate how to address system issues, any changes to the structure, institutional or engineering controls, and property transfers. So one of the best ways to encourage longevity of this critical information is to tie it to the system. Label with contact information on a sticker, physically tie the manual to the system, include a closure letter if applicable, or a copy of administrative controls that clarify responsibility for that long-term operation and maintenance of the system. All right, so we're going to go ahead and have a knowledge check. So we've made it this far. So Sarah's opening the poll here for you, and we want to select one answer. So when is it important to do public outreach? Is it during the vapor intrusion investigation, during mitigation design and planning, at the time of mitigation implementation, during long-term management, or all of the above? And Sarah, I will leave it to you to know when to end the poll here and let us know what the answers are.
All right, we'll give it about 5 more seconds and then we'll go ahead and launch those answers.
Oh, excellent. Successful day. The vast majority selected all of the above, which is correct. It really needs to be happening throughout the entire life of the project. Okay. So the next portion of this is about when, Actually, I'm not sure why I didn't advance again. Here, all of the above. Yay. So say the beginning public outreach needs to begin, you know, at the beginning of the vapor investigation. And although that's not the focus of our fact sheet, it's just important to remember. It has to happen all the time. And the next three bullets are things that we talked about, how while the reason and the focus of outreach might change as the project progresses, the need is continual, and that's really important. So this includes making sure that the right people are educated and engaged in that long-term management of the system. So if the system, this is the key point, if the system isn't maintained because of inadequate communication on the management plan, then there's no point in doing the investigation and putting the system in the first place if it's not going to remain protective. Okay, so here are some additional resources for you. As stated at the start of this section, public outreach does have its own fact sheet, and it focuses on the difference with public outreach for vapor intrusion than for other environmental work. Another good resource is what was discussed already, the ITRC Petroleum VI guidance from 2014. That includes a detailed section on community engagement, which is section 7. And then ITRC published a risk communication toolkit in June of 2020. This is also a really great resource. It dives deep into the complexities and strategies for successfully communicating with the public on health risk from environmental contamination. The risk communication toolkit it's not specific to vapor intrusion by any means, but it is directly applicable. Go ahead and advance to that last slide. So we do also have more resources in the public outreach fact sheet, like plain language principles. So thank you for listening, and I'm going to turn it over to Sarah to go into question and answer.
So, excuse me. Yes, thank you, Jennifer. We are now going to open up the question answer session. Like I said at the beginning, we'll have a Q&A session now, and then we will also have a second one at the completion of the rest of the module. At any time, you can type your questions into the Q&A pod in the bottom corner of your screen, and we will try to get through as many questions as possible in each of the Q&A sessions. So we will begin. Looks like we have two questions, excuse me, right now. Our trainers have also been going through during the module and answering some of your questions that you may have already asked in the Q&A pod. So if you want to check back and see if your question has been answered, you can do that as well. But starting with the first question we have here, it says, I have a question about subslab vapor monitoring during operation and maintenance phase. Subslab vapor sampling often comes with two probes, one above vapor barrier and one below. As vapor barrier is directly below the slab, I am wondering whether the small space between the slab and the barrier may limit air circulation and affect the representativeness of above barrier sampling for a building. If that is the case, what is the purpose of the above barrier vapor sampling? Would any of our trainers like to take a stab at this one?
I can. This is Laurent Levy, and then others feel free to respond. So it would be for new construction, obviously, in which case you would have the ability to sample under your barrier and above your barrier. So it would depend on how the design looks like. But generally, if that was built that way, they would be above the vapor barrier. There'd be perhaps a protection with a geotextile and then some fill material. I don't know. I can't remember how many inches of that, but there'd be some space above that barrier with the ability to sample that space with that additional port. And you could use that as kind of a surveillance layer to confirm that the barrier is doing the barrier and mitigation system, the pressurization system. If there's one beneath the barrier, it's doing, if both are doing their job properly. So technically above the barrier, you would have non-detect in the subslab. So generally, there'd be enough space and not an issue with space. But again, that all depends on the design. And I hope that answered that question. If others have additional insight, please go ahead.
All right, if not, we will move on to our next question, which asks, what measures have been taken to prevent the sensed intrusion from unidentified sources? We smelled petroleum in the resident's house, but we were unable to find the source of the intrusion. Would any trainers like to answer that one?
This is Kelly here. That can be difficult. I mean, an important thing, a couple thoughts come to mind. An important thing there is to make sure you've got a good inventory of what's inside the house currently, to make sure you're not getting background, you know, that there's nothing emitting petroleum vapors that you could take out of the house before trying to look harder. But if you've, and probably also some site history would help there in terms of knowing, I mean, if they had a UST or something like that, or heating oil tank, or some, you know, some reason that they would have had a release there might help. But if you're just detecting it with your nose, but you can't find any other evidence, especially like if you sampled analytically or anything like that, that can be pretty difficult. There's no good answer to that one, kind of without more details and thinking harder about the site. But it does go to show that VI is not straightforward, and especially not simple for all sites.
And some messages that my microphone might be fuzzy, so I apologize for that. We are going to move on, so thank you for the questions. We'll have another opportunity to answer questions at the end of the class today. We will be moving on to the next slide and turning it over to Eric with Bar Engineering. So welcome, Eric.
Hello. Thank you, Sarah. If we can get the slides to go here. There we go. Okay, so as Sarah mentioned, my name is Eric Blodgett. I'm with Bar Engineering Company, and I'm going to be talking about rapid response for vapor intrusion mitigation. So starting with some learning objectives, as you're watching this module, you should be coming across three key ideas. So the first one is, what is a rapid response, and you know how it may differ from a long-term vapor intrusion mitigation strategy. Second, you should be able to recognize the conditions under which a rapid response may be appropriate. And then third, you should be familiar with what we call the administrative and engineering controls that are available for rapid response. And I'll talk in more detail about those, but the three that we are including are preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation, indoor air treatment, and HVAC modification. There we go. A little bit of a delay on my side. So what is rapid response? A rapid response is an interim vapor intrusion mitigation approach that might be appropriate under certain conditions. We're talking, conditions where there's high concentrations of contaminants in indoor air and or when you have sensitive populations present. And you would implement this prior to your long-term mitigation strategy. So for the purposes of this module, we've defined a rapid response as one that could be implemented on a timescale of days to weeks. And so it's important to remember that the main purpose of a rapid response is to address acute risk. So I'm sure there's many folks on the call today that are familiar with the chemical trichloroethylene or TCE. This compound is seen as presenting an acute risk from exposure by vapor intrusion. And so we consider a rapid response an interim action because it can be implemented prior to your final mitigation strategy, whatever that may be. And a long-term strategy such as a subslab depressurization system or others that you'll hear a lot more about in the second session of this training, those typically take longer to both design and implement, but they may be more effective in the long term at addressing vapor intrusion. Although I do want to point out that in many circumstances, the efforts that you do during rapid response, such as crack sealing, those can carry over or supplement your permanent mitigation strategy. The requirement for rapid response can vary from state to state and between regulatory programs. The criteria that trigger a rapid response, you know, when do we have to do this? That can vary, as well as the time frame, can vary between between jurisdictions. What qualifies as rapid? And then lastly, you'll see here on the right hand side of the slide, the terminology used to describe rapid response can vary. But really, there's always two common factors, and that is, you know, like I mentioned, we've got an acute risk present, and then what you're doing is an interim action that's needed before long-term mitigation can be implemented. So as Kelly mentioned, I just wanted to reiterate this, even though this is the rapid response section, we're still kind of limiting our scope here in this module to chemical vapor intrusion that may present an acute human health risk. So if it's an emergency situation, definitely first responders should be contacted immediately. And so now it's time for the first knowledge check of this module. The question here is, which of the scenarios could warrant a rapid response? Petroleum vapor intrusion has been documented in a vacant gas station. High levels of TCE have been detected in subslab soil gas at a maternity clinic. TCE levels have been detected slightly above state regulatory criteria in an occupied commercial building. Or benzene has been detected at high levels in soil gas at a vacant lot that is planned for future redevelopment. So Sarah, I'll let you watch the responses and close out the poll when you're ready. All right, so 92% got this one right. And the reasoning behind that is, you know, as I mentioned, we've got an acute risk that is present. We're talking about TCE, which presents an acute risk. And then also we've got a sensitive population present that's going to require, you know, an interim action right away. Okay, so just like the other modules, there are more resources in addition to this training on ITRC's website. Specifically for rapid response, we have one fact sheet and then we have three text sheets. The fact sheet is essentially just an overview similar to the material that I'm going over today with a brief description of administrative and engineering controls that are available for rapid response. And then the three text sheets dive into greater detail and provide information about the three engineering controls that are available for a rapid response, which I will get into more in the following slides. So as Lila and Laurent talked about the broad CSM, you know, they kind of covered all mitigation approaches or all potential mitigation approaches. And for that, you know, we saw that often we're focused on the building structure. We're focused a lot of times on the zone below the slab of the building. And then as you'll see in the next module, sometimes we even focus on the contaminant sources themselves. But for rapid response, we can narrow in and focus on a few key areas. We're really focused on the building and what's inside of it. So the three elements that are important for the CSM for rapid response are the building occupants themselves, the preferential pathways that we've been talking about today, and then also the building pressure and the building air exchange rate. So at a high level, what we've done is divided rapid responses into two categories, and those are administrative controls and engineering controls. The first category, administrative controls, this is simply notification and providing the building occupant with information. And this could be, general generic 101, vapor intrusion 101 style fact sheets, or it could be something more site specific if there's more information available and it's appropriate. As Jennifer mentioned, this would actually be a really good time to consider partnering with a local health agency or regulatory agency so that you can coordinate those notification efforts. Next, relocation. So this is simply removing occupants from the structure where vapor intrusion is happening. And so, relocation is fairly drastic measure. It's really not all that common in my experience, but we do have to consider it as it may be prudent in specific situations, where we have exceedingly high concentrations of contaminants in indoor air and or sensitive populations are present, similar to the maternity clinic scenario that we looked at in the knowledge check. So the other category of rapid response measures is I've been talking about these engineering controls. So engineering controls are physical changes that are made to a building or the way building systems function. And the goal here is to eliminate exposure to contaminants entering the building from vapor intrusion. And I'm going to focus on three of these technologies that can be implemented rapidly. The first one is actually two categories grouped together. So we've got preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation. A quick note on terminology here. So today we've been saying preferential pathway a lot, but there are other terms that are used. These include atypical vapor intrusion pathways, alternative vapor intrusion pathways, or conduit vapor intrusion. So preferential pathway sealing involves closing or sealing large openings in the building envelope. These openings allow a lot of vapors to enter, while ad hoc ventilation involves increasing the air exchange rate within a building by opening the windows and doors. Second rapid response engineering control technology here is indoor air treatment. So this involves deploying an air purifying unit or an APU with the goal of reducing concentrations in indoor air directly. And last, we've got HVAC modification. So this involves changing the way the building is ventilated or the way that the building is pressurized with the goal of diluting the concentrations of contaminants in indoor air and or preventing the vapors from entering the building in the first place. So in this second half of the module, I'm going to focus on these three engineering controls: preferential pathway sealing and ad hoc ventilation, indoor air treatment, and HVAC modification. And so for each one of these, I'll give a brief overview. I'll talk about components of each of these technologies and then some additional considerations. But before we get into that, we're going to do a poll. So we want to see what all the audience has experience with here. So you can check more than one answer, and you should select the administrative or engineering controls that you have either implemented or have seen implemented. And again, I'll leave it up to Sarah to call it. There we go. So looks like a broad range. So this is similar to other trainings that we've offered. It looks like we've seen a little bit of everything. Like I said, relocation, not all that common, coming in as the least frequent option that folks have seen here. But a lot some of this material might be familiar to you, but hopefully learning something new along the way as well. So when we're thinking about how vapors enter a building and pass through the building envelope, we need to consider two mechanisms that we touched on in the CSM section, and those are advection and diffusion. Diffusion is a slow process where vapor phase contaminants migrate from an area of high concentration to an area of lower concentration. Whereas advection is really flow. It's the transport of vapor phase contaminants by airflow. And so if you think about it, advection is driven by pressure, and it can account for the majority of contaminant flux into a building. And this is especially true when there are large openings in that building envelope where that flow can occur. The purpose of preferential pathway sealing then is to directly block those pathways and sort of shut off that advective flow. Examples of these types of openings can include, larger floor cracks, not your typical floor crack, but larger floor cracks, gaps around utility penetrations, gaps at foundation walls or cold joints. And then, as we mentioned in the CSM section, any kind of conduit connected to a drain tile sump or a land drain. And then also, areas of the slab that are just deteriorated or damaged. So here, really blocking these openings is, you get a really high ROI. It's very low cost, and it's very effective at reducing a significant amount of flux of contaminants into the building. Ad hoc ventilation, this is pretty simple. Opening windows and doors can increase the air exchange in a building, thereby diluting the concentration of contaminants in indoor air. Moving on to components. So we've got some pictures diagram here. These are the general components of preferential pathway sealing. It includes caulks and sealants that can be applied to these cracks and gaps that I mentioned. Key here is, when you're selecting these materials, you have to pay attention to the properties. Ideally, we want something flexible and non-shrinking, so that it can kind of move as the building might move. You want to know, do these materials contain VOCs that could off-gas and affect indoor air sampling that you're doing? And then also, do you need to prepare the area first? Do you need to sand it, remove paint, remove coatings. For the larger openings, you can do on-the-fly solutions, or there's, off-the-shelf products for things like sumps that can cover and still allow the pipes and the electrical cords to come through. And then also here in the center of the slide, we've got a diagram showing sewer vapor intrusion. So in this scenario, you've got vapors that enter a building through a dry drain. And so then those dry drains or P-traps can be filled with water, or in the case of a rarely used drain, vegetable oil or something else that doesn't evaporate. Moving on to indoor air treatment. So indoor air treatment, as I mentioned, is implemented by deploying these APUs inside of a building or in the specific area that vapor intrusion is suspected. APUs work by pulling air in, treating it, and then discharging it back into the indoor airspace. Really important here, limitation wise, APUs take up space, they make noise, they have to be plugged in, and so they are subject to occupant interference. And so if someone is obviously unplugging it and tucking it in the closet so that it's not making noise in their conference room or in their bedroom, it's going to be a lot less effective or not effective at all. So here we've got a diagram of how one of these APUs works. So in this scenario, untreated air is drawn into the unit by an internal fan. It passes through a series of filter units to remove particulates and the chemicals that we're concerned with. And then it exits the unit as treated air. The photo on the right side is a typical APU that's readily available. And here the important consideration is two, really. So when you're selecting and sizing APUs, you have to think about number one, what are the chemicals that are going to be in the indoor air because of vapor intrusion? But also, what are the VOCs and chemicals going to be in indoor air because of those indoor air sort of background sources that we've been talking about? Those are going to exert, a load on the consumption of carbon, as well as the VOCs coming from vapor intrusion. And then in terms of, the size or volume of indoor airspace that you're trying to treat, that's going to determine the size and how many APUs are going to need to be deployed. So HVAC modification, this is the last technology that I'm going to discuss, and it involves changing the way an HVAC system operates to increase the amount of fresh air that's coming into the building and or to increase the building pressure to prevent those vapors from entering from below. And I want to note here that this technology can be implemented for rapid response, but it's also been shown to be effective and function as a long-term mitigation strategy as well. And this is especially true when it's supplemented with other VI mitigation methods like preferential pathway sealing or even in addition to subslab depressurization or venting. Also want to note that this technology is really best suited for larger commercial or industrial buildings. These buildings tend to have fairly sophisticated HVAC systems that can be modified. And so, the HVAC modification really is generally not applicable to, say, like a single family home residential setting, because those HVAC systems are just generally less modifiable to address vapor intrusion. So this diagram shows the basic elements of a typical HVAC system. But before I walk through it, I just want to put out a phrase that has helped me think about this process. And it's air in, air out, because this is really the basis for any sort of changes that you would make to an HVAC system and the way that it operates in order to mitigate vapor intrusion. So first, excuse me. Fresh air enters the system and is distributed through supply air ducts by a supply air fan. That process is shown here in blue on the slide. So here, increasing the supply air fan speed or opening the dampers will increase air in. Next, we have air from the occupied space of the building that is removed by return air ducts and a return air fan. That's shown in green here. The return air fan also exhausts a portion of the air outside and sends air back to the supply fan to be recycled through the building. So in this process, increasing the return air fan speed or decreasing the amount of recycled air will increase air out. So when we're thinking about these two processes, to increase air exchange rate and with the goal of diluting contaminants in indoor air, we could increase both the supply and return air fans, and we could also reduce the portion of air that is recycled. Whereas if we wanted to pressurize the building to prevent vapors from entering, We would increase the supply air fan to be greater than that of the return air fan. In addition to our main HVAC system, there can also be these separate exhaust fans, and these are really important to consider when doing HVAC modification. These include things like, you know, bathroom fans, fans above range hoods or fume hoods. Exhaust fans can really complicate HVAC modification because they increase air out and they act to depressurize the building. And in a lot of cases, they haven't been considered in the way that the HVAC system is operated and how much makeup air it needs. So it's important to identify any sort of exhaust fans and then consider them when you're making HVAC modifications. And then the last thing I'll say before the next module is that, you know, this is a simplified version, a greatly simplified version of a typical HVAC system. In real life, they are typically more complicated. And so it's important to enlist facility staff or a licensed HVAC contractor or even a mechanical engineer to ensure that, you know, the changes that you make to the HVAC system don't inadvertently make vapor intrusion conditions worse. So with that, I am going to hand it over to Marek to talk about remediation and institutional controls.
Marek, if you're there, you might have to turn on your microphone so we can all hear you.
No, I'm here, but I don't have the control or the slides.
You should now.
Okay. Hey, hello, I'm Marek Ostrowski. I'm with Brown and Coldwell in New Jersey, and I'll be speaking about the environmental remediation and institutional controls. Remediation is a vast subject, and of course, we're not going to address much of it here, but it has to be stressed that this is in relation to the VI mitigation. The remediation and institutional controls as they affect or relate to VI mitigation. So the goal is to provide an overview of how certain technologies can do double duty and do both remediation and mitigation, and provide introduction to the ICs. So we'll talk about the differences and also similarities between the two. We'll describe two soil vapor remediation methods that can do the double duty and address the VI as well, and provide a brief introduction to the ICs. And at the end, the listeners should be able to at least recognize the key factors that are used in evaluating whether those two are actually applicable to your site. So remediation versus mitigation. There are similarities between them and there are differences, and they're frequently a matter of degree as opposed to, you know, binary zero or one. That said, however, there's certain very characteristic things about either one of them that actually can be identified to differentiate between the two. Just keep in mind that it's not always, you know, a full difference or similarities is a matter of degree frequently. So starting with remediation, remediation generally attempts to reduce the source mass, either in the soil, groundwater, or free product. It is frequently associated with reduction of exposure, but reduction of the mass of COCs is generally the main objective. It is frequently applied in a site-wide manner. The site can be divided into operable units or done gradually, but generally the objective is to remediate the whole site, and not only the site, but also offsite areas, because the site can affect the offsite areas, for example, a plume emanating from your site. And remediation has generally long-term installation. And it says months here, but I think, you know, most of us are familiar with sites that took years or decades, right, to remediate. On the other hand, mitigation is not that much concerned with reduction of mass as it is mostly or only with preventing exposure. And the last point on the right-hand side says that may also provide a remediation benefit, but that's generally a side effect. That's not its major objective. And where the remediation was site-wide, mitigation is generally building-specific. Of course, not always. Sometimes you can have mitigation over large areas, but most of the time we're dealing with a particular building where VI is occurring. And it generally there's frequently a requirement for the mitigation to be performed within a set time, and that time is much shorter than for remediation. It's weeks or months. So those are some key, you know, similarities and differences between the two. And as it was mentioned before, VI mitigation is required when there is a source of the vapor in the vadose zone, there is an exposure pathway, and the two are significant enough to drive human health risk. Mitigation addresses the pathway, whereas the remediation can address both. And there are two remediation technologies that can be applied in that matter, and those are soil vapor extraction and multi-phase extraction. And we have tech sheets for those two at our ITRC website. So you can take a look at those and get more information. Here, I mean, two really key things have to be emphasized. Probably some of the key takeaways from this module is that sometimes VI mitigation is not enough. If there is specific conditions, for example, a very active and concentrated source very close to the slab, like let's say NAPL, or very high concentrations, remediation may actually be required even though you have mitigation. So that's, you have to keep that in mind, that remediation is sometimes a requirement regardless. And the other one is that there is a lot of different technologies for remediation, and most of them are not directly intended to affect VI. However, they can. And they can do that either in a positive way or affect it adversely. So for example, technologies that produce soil vapor like ISCO or thermal, or redirect the flow of soil gas like capping or sheet pile walls, may result in increase in VI in nearby structures. And conversely, technologies that reduce the COC concentration in the source can actually help. For example, if you have a plume emanating from your site and you need to do VI mitigation within the plume, if you remediate the source of the plume, that plume will gradually collapse and remove the need to have VI mitigation over that area. So that's something to keep in mind, that even though you don't intend to affect VI with remediation, you sometimes may. So the first technology that I will speak about is soil vapor extraction. And for those who are familiar with stop slab depressurization systems, which were mentioned here before several times and will be discussed in detail in session two, SV is very similar to that. It's kind of can be described as SSDS on steroids. It has larger depths because SSDS is under the slab, whereas SV has to go where the source is. Higher flows, higher pressures or higher vacuums, and need for treatment of the extracted soil gas. So what SV can do is SV targets only the vadose zone, right? You need to have a relatively thick vadose zone to to apply SV. It intercepts the soil vapor, but by means of creating a gradient away from the building slab. So what you see here is you have an SVE well. It could be a trench, could be a well. Here you have a well, which is installed in the source zone. That well is connected to a blower that creates vacuum and extracts air. And that air is then treated in the air treatment system and discharged into the atmosphere. And those systems can create enough vacuum to actually act in the same way as subslab depressurization systems and protect the building from VI intrusion. Design considerations for those. Well, first of all, you need to have unsaturated zone, right? If there is water right under the slab, then that will not work. The soils under the building need to be relatively permeable. You have clay, it's not going to work. A lot of the things that are, you know, design considerations for this were actually discussed in the CSM module. So, you know, what is the building, what is the slab, and things of that nature. Where is it applicable? Well, probably the biggest constraint here is that VI mitigation needs to be implemented in a short time. So if you have, you know, one building and you can get an SVE system quickly, let's say repurposed or a rental, and quickly install it, then you may actually make that time. So then it's applicable. SVE as a remediation technology is applicable to large sites, of course, but that takes a long time, you know, to test, install, and generally is too long for VI mitigation. So we're talking single building, small, something that can be done relatively quickly. So one very important thing to discuss here is the exit strategy. The reason being that remediation and mitigation may have different exit strategies. SVE generally for remediation is applied to reach certain cleanup objectives in the soil as confirmed by soil sampling. And that is not the same as protecting the building from the vapors. So when you're using that for SVE for remediation, you have to be very cognizant of that. So for example, one example from my practice is that there was a site where initially SVE was implemented and you know, it acted as a VI mitigation system as well, but then the cleanup was accomplished, you know, soil sampling was done, and SVE was turned off. Well, after that, there was an SSDS system that kind of picked up the slack because SSDS systems are less costly to operate than SVE systems. So the end point, the exit strategy has to be factored into considerations, whether you use it and what do you use after it's done. Another technology is multi-phase extraction. I'm not going to talk too much about it because it's very similar to SVE. It also extracts air, creating vacuum and acting the same way as SSDS. The difference here is that where SVE is applicable only to unsaturated zones, MPE can actually make its own unsaturated zone because in addition to extracting soil gas, it also extracts liquids like water or an apple. So by extracting groundwater, it can create drawdown, drop the water level, create an unsaturated zone, and then that constraint is removed. So it's not linked to the vadose zone thickness. So additional complication here is that, well, you extract liquids. So in addition to treating the air discharge, you have to also get rid of the NAPL or treat the groundwater that you extracted. And of course, the exit strategy, the same thing as with SVE, it has to be really considered in detail what to do after the MPE is discontinued. Are we done with the VI mitigation or is there still need for further VI mitigation? So switching gears, we're going to talk about institutional controls. So that's kind of a knowledge check or polling the audience. Have you ever been involved with a site that has some sort of institutional controls, like deed restrictions, land use controls, control of VI mitigation strategy? If so, check all that apply. And Sarah, I'll let you let me know when we can proceed. So construction requirements, for example, you can have a requirement to address contaminated soil during construction. Building type prohibits single family homes. Occupancy prohibit acres at the ground level, and so on and so forth. Okay, and looks like we have a very broad spectrum of experiences that the listeners have with institutional controls. Yes. As part of this training, there is a fact sheet for institutional controls, which is also available at the ITRC website, together with the fact sheets for SVE and NPE. So when it comes to institutional controls, those are long-term measures that provide protection from exposure to contaminants and essentially assure that VI mitigation system will be maintained if needed. And of course, as seen here, they do not have to be alone. They could be in combination with other mitigation measures. And they can be divided essentially into those four categories that you see here. And government controls, those are measures usually implemented and enforced by the state or by the local government. Things like zoning ordinances or groundwater use or drilling limitations. So, for example, here in New Jersey, the classification exception area for groundwater, limiting or prohibiting groundwater use is a good example of that. Zoning ordinances could be. It's a legal authority by the local government to regulate the land use. For example, you cannot have residential buildings in a particular location because of the VI or something like that. The next category are the proprietary controls, and those are kind of different from the other ones because they run with the land. They are based on real property law, and well, they can be implemented between two parties with or without the use or the participation of the government, but essentially they are kind of ensconced in the deed of the property. So the next owner or the next owners are also required to abide by them. And an example here is an easement. For example, if there is a VI system at the property, and the owner is not the operator, the owner has to grant the operator an easement to access the system for maintenance and so on, or an easement for conservation, or it could be like an Environmental Covenant Act that entitles the owner to limit the use of the property. Right? Enforcement mechanisms. Those are again, those do not run with the land. Those are things like permits and administrative orders and consent decrees. They're enforceable by state and federal agencies, and they are binding only the signatories of those acts. So they can, for example, force the owner to perform certain action or not perform certain actions, or if they're consent orders, they are actually mitigated by the court's approval of the use of the property or certain actions. And the last one is the informational devices. Those are not legally binding, and they generally just inform the public or the owners, potential owners of the future owners of the property about, say, VI issues at the property. So sometimes those things are put into the deed notice, or they can include things like state registries of waste sites, hazardous waste sites, or advisories, warnings to the public, signage, and things of that nature. So here's a knowledge check. At what point might you consider using ICs at your site? So You have a remediated site that includes a passive venting system or includes an active system. You have a site where there is a potential for future land development, all of the above, none of the above. Sarah, again, I'll let you let me know when it's done. Okay, yeah, the answer definitely is all of the above, and more too. Okay, so that concludes this module. There are a couple of resources that ITRC has on various remediation technologies, which are listed here. Just with that, I'll turn it over to Kelly for concluding remarks.
All right. So thank you so much, Marek. Just give me one moment.
All right, thank you so much again. We are now going to open up our second Q&A. So like I said earlier, you can type your questions into the Q&A pod in the bottom corner of your screen, and we're going to try to get through as many questions as we can. So starting with our first question, have you, any of the trainers, seen an SVE system used to reduce soil gas concentrations of TCE where historical source removal was conducted and the remaining GW plume is thought to be the only source?
So I can speak to that. That generally would not happen because SVE only addresses the vadose zone. So when you have groundwater issues, then SVE is not your technology. It could be applied together with others. For example, if you're using air sparging, then you have to extract the air to prevent the VI intrusion using SVE, but by itself, it does not address the saturated zone.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Thing. I guess sometimes you do, even though the SVE is not doing a whole lot for removing mass, you just keep it in place because it also provide a form of vapor mitigation for the building. So, and it's, you know, if you don't have to treat with carbon, it's essentially just the power, the cost of electricity. So you'll just leave it because it doesn't hurt to do so.
Yeah, so if you know you don't want to install an SSDS system or you don't have an SSDS system, which is, you know, less expensive to operate, then yes, you can leave it, but it's not going to affect your groundwater, right?
All right, thank you, trainers. Our next question is, for lowland coastal areas with tidal flux, is there a model for a plume that moves, either long-term from sea level or short-term like construction dewatering?
Are we talking about the plume in groundwater?
I believe so.
Yeah, so there is all kinds of models for the propagation of plumes. When you're talking about tidal, it's very, very difficult because models are generally not good at dealing with small time frames like that where things change. So I'm not really familiar with a specific model for tidal. You probably could use the more, you know, commercial known models and just use a lot of time periods, right? A lot of stress periods for that. But it would be difficult. It would be difficult. One way that you can do it is to go into averaging, right? So average your flow and gradients and all that. But that's probably not what you're looking for. So it would be difficult and complicated to do.
Which reads, recognizing that subslab conditions, for example, soil type, existence of gravel, capillary break, etc. Do you have guidance on the density or number, SSD or SSV points per square footage of building area, assuming all other conditions are equal?
Yeah, this is Kelly here. That can vary a good bit from state to state as well. In North Carolina, our default VI guidance is written for 1 per 1,000 square feet, which is quite a lot. And we'll typically kind of modify that as needed down from there. But you would one main thing is to try to target areas of, like, especially if you're going for ROI or radius of influence testing, areas of least expected influence. Like a area isolated from a with a thickened footer or something like that.
All right, thank you, Kelly. And with that, I want to say a huge thank you to all of our expert trainers for being here with us today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would love to hear back from all of our participants today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that is linked here on this last slide. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to also receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on answers or would like to ask more questions, please feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. The second session of this vapor intrusion mitigation training will be held on Thursday, March 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern, which will serve as a continuation of today's training, and it will also dive deeper into active mitigation approaches, passive mitigation approaches, system verification, OM&M, and exit strategies as they all relate to vapor intrusion mitigation. So, thank you so much, and that concludes today's module.